So welcome to Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. This is the 2.0 version for those of you who have possibly joined in before and have over the last couple of years to the old Brown Bag Wednesday webinars. Things are just a little bit different now and coming to you from the Broadcast Blue network. But I'm going to bring you these webinars every Wednesday when I can, even on the road if I can. I'll be at the ILETA conference in March, and I'll probably be doing a Brown Bag Wednesday webinar live from the conference floor. So I'll try and get these things to you. If you can check out the webinar room, and you can also go to broadcast.blue for information. If there's a particular Wednesday where I'm going to have to either change the time or not do one at all, you can find information about the schedule. I'm going to make that available at www.broadcast.blue. It's our name is our website address, so it's really convenient. That's actually an extension now for the URLs, .blue, so broadcast.blue. All the information you could possibly want, you can find on that particular one. So let's go ahead and talk about the case of the week that we have for this first edition of the 2.0 version of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinars. Edition 2018-01, United States versus Coffle from the 11th Circuit, actually came from the Northern District of Florida, which is over there in the Panhandle. It's not, some people think the Northern District of Florida goes up to Jacksonville and that area on the east side of the state, and it does not. That is the Middle District of Florida, stretches from Jacksonville down to Orlando to Tampa, a huge swath across the middle of the state. This comes from around the Tallahassee area and the Panhandle of Florida, very pretty out there. And the 11th Circuit decided this case a little bit less than a month ago, back in December, right before Christmas, December 14th, 2017. So let's take a look at this case, United States versus Coffle. Now, there are some key phrases. I like to make the key phrases and the key cases available for you right up front before we even get started. So the key phrases for the webinar are search and seizure, government action, warrant application, scope of search, plain view seizure, and subjective motivation. We also have some key cases and Supreme Court cases, and the only cases I ever include in the key cases section are Supreme Court cases. So even if they cite a circuit court decision, if it is guided by a Supreme Court decision, I will add that as well. United States versus Jacobson, Brigham City, Utah versus Stewart, Horton v. California, and Franks v. Delaware. Four very important cases and probably familiar cases that most of you are familiar with. Okay, so let's take a look at the actual facts in this case. It's an interesting case. This is actually a picture of the defendant in this case, and actually the trailer where the search took place. So the defendant Coffle lived in a trailer. He rented this trailer from a rental company. It was managed by a company called Blue Key Property Management, and as a result of having a trailer and that he's renting, there's the management company is also responsible for maintenance. Well, his stove, he had a range, a stove oven combination, a range that went out in the trailer, and the maintenance company sent a maintenance man into the trailer in order to fix it. Well, when the maintenance man showed up, Coffle's not there. And so the maintenance guy used a master key, as they do, in order to gain access to the trailer in order to replace this oven that Coffle had reported was broken. So once he's inside, there's a circuit breaker. The range is hardwired, and he has to go to a circuit breaker in order to disconnect the power so he can disconnect the old range in order to put the new one in. And he's going to where the breaker is, one of the bedrooms where the breaker is, but there is the door is locked. He can't get inside, and so he uses a screwdriver to open this locked door to gain access to the locked to this room, and he accesses the circuit breaker. So he goes in there to access this breaker, and when he goes in, he sees that what appears to him to be marijuana plants under these lights, grow lights, that were connected directly to the circuit breaker box, and he took pictures of all of this with his cell phone. Now, wonderful, the technology now, things that you're able to do. He took pictures of these plants and what he had observed while he was in there. He takes all these pictures on his phone, and then he goes to law enforcement, and he contacts law enforcement. Now, based on the information that they have been provided with from this maintenance guy, the law enforcement officers obtained a search warrant. They took the photographs and the statements of the this person, this maintenance person, and they went and they obtained a warrant to search the trailer. Before they go to execute the warrant, they're doing a little research on the person who lives there, and they find out that Coffle, the resident of this trailer, had previously been convicted of a felony. So they know before they show up, they know before they execute the warrant that he's a convicted felon. During the search of the trailer, they go to execute the warrant. They do everything they're required. And they go to execute the warrant. They go into the trailer. They find marijuana plants. They find the grow materials and containers of marijuana that had been harvested. They also found four firearms and nearly 1,500 rounds of ammunition and a silencer. And it turns out that this silencer is not registered as required under federal law. So those are the facts that lead to what's going to happen here when we go to trial. Well, at trial, as you might imagine, the defense attorney is going to do what the defense attorney is going to do. And in this particular case, the defense attorney says, "Hey, that's not fair," uses that defense F word, and says, "Hey, that's not fair," and makes arguments that there were actions that were violations of the Fourth Amendment. And specifically, the defense attorney made three arguments. First, the defense argued that the search of the trailer by the maintenance man was a Fourth Amendment violation, and by forcing his way into the room with a screwdriver. And the argument was that, and it was based on a Katz argument and not a Jones type of physical intrusion. It was based on a REP. That Coffle had a reasonable expectation of privacy in that room, and that therefore it was a violation of the Fourth Amendment to actually to go into the trailer and then to subsequently go into the room itself. So just the entry into the trailer and then the entry into the room, violations of the Fourth Amendment being unreasonable searches. They next argued that the law enforcement officers exceeded the scope of the search warrant by searching for and seizing firearms and ammunition. And it's interesting to note that in the case, when he was actually prosecuted, he was indicted on one count of possessing a firearm as a convicted felon and in violation of 18 United States Code Section 922G. That's a G1 offense, the prohibited person of convicted felon. And one count of possessing a silencer that's not registered, which is also another violation of federal law. But apparently, there weren't any drug offense charges. It seems that the government was much more interested in the firearms violation than they were in the marijuana. And often that is the case because firearms offenses are usually considerably more serious when it comes to the possible punishment involved. And so the argument that they're saying is, hey, look, they went in there on a warrant to search and seize marijuana, and what they searched and seized instead were firearms and ammunition. And that they also made an argument that that was their intent all the time, that subjectively the officers were more interested in finding firearms and ammunition than they were in looking for the marijuana and the grow materials that were authorized by the warrant. And so therefore they exceeded the scope, which would make the search unreasonable as well. And then lastly, they argued that there should be a Franks hearing because the law enforcement officers omitted material information from the search warrant, namely the fact that Coffle was a prior convicted felon, that he had a felony conviction, and that was a material part of the charge, and yet it was not in the warrant itself. And so what they are doing, and by the way, the district court denied the motion to suppress, but what the defense attorney is clearly doing here is trying to argue that there's a bad domino. And most of the folks that are watching this live, I know have heard me talk about this before, but for those who haven't, real quickly, just the whole concept is that one Fourth Amendment decision typically leads to another. I don't think I've ever read a case where there was a single one single Fourth Amendment issue that didn't involve any other Fourth Amendment issue at all. Even if it's just an arrest, you're going to do a search incident to arrest. That's going to be a separate Fourth Amendment domino. So these Fourth Amendment issues, these Fourth Amendment decisions typically line up one after another. And the validity of each Fourth Amendment decision is predicated on the validity of the one that came immediately before it. And so once these Fourth Amendment decisions start, if there's a Fourth Amendment decision that's bad in this series of Fourth Amendment decisions, this series of Fourth Amendment dominoes, if you will, if there's one that's bad, then all the ones downstream of the bad domino will be bad as well. And when you have this concept of the dominoes falling, typically the last domino, what you would see is the red domino in the video right now. Typically, that last domino is the evidence that we want to admit in order to find a defendant guilty. It's the evidence that's either seized pursuant to a warrant or seized pursuant to the plain view seizure doctrine without a warrant. And so it's that evidence that's typically that very last red domino. And so if the defense can show that any of the dominoes that came before that are bad, then that last domino will be bad as well. And the argument will be the evidence should be suppressed. They're arguing three separate dominoes in this point. They're arguing first, the search of the trailer was bad. And if the court disagrees with that and says that's okay, they're going to go to the downstream. They're going to say, well, the scope of the search by the law enforcement officers who were executing the warrant was unreasonable because they exceeded the scope. That would be a bad domino. And then they're arguing that law enforcement omitted material information in obtaining the warrant itself, which would have been the domino that came before the actual search. So we have three, they get three bites at the apple. They're making three separate arguments. And if they win on any of these three arguments, then the evidence is going to be suppressed. So they have these alternative arguments that they're making, hoping they can get one of them to stick. And before we look at what the circuit court did in the 11th Circuit up there in Atlanta, let's first look at some legal blasts from the past, some controlling law that the court is going to use in order to determine what the outcome should be in this particular case. And this is a I like to take this opportunity to use these not only as an update. Let's talk about the case and see what's going on. And that's always a lot of fun, but it's a good refresher. And so the legal blasts from the past, let's take a look at a few of them just to have a refresher on these legal concepts that are very, very important that the circuit court will use in reaching their decision. Okay, the first one is United States versus Jacobson. And this is a very important Supreme Court case from back in 1984. And when we're teaching Fourth Amendment law, whether I'm teaching it in a federal academy, which I used to do, or if I'm teaching it out in private somewhere, as I do now, this is fundamental concept that was set forth in United States versus Jacobson is this concept that a search by a private person does not implicate the Fourth Amendment unless this person is acting as an instrument or agent of the government. And it's an important reminder that the first eight amendments to the Constitution, which are the true Bill of Rights collectively, provide individual freedoms from certain types of government action. They don't protect us from each other. They protect us from the government and certain types of action. And in the Fourth Amendment, it protects us from unreasonable government searches and seizures. So although you don't see the word government anywhere in the Fourth Amendment, it's implied that it only applies to government action. Now, it's possible for a private person to become a government actor, like a confidential informant or someone who is acting at the direction or sometimes just with the knowledge and permission of the government to turn that action into government action. But that is what's required in order for a private person to trigger the Fourth Amendment. They have to be acting as an instrument or an agent of the government. If they're not, then it does not trigger the Fourth Amendment. You see a lot of this in the First Amendment, and regardless of where you fall on the whole concept of the taking a knee during the national anthem and the Kaepernick issues that are going on. I hear a lot of people saying, well, that's his First Amendment right. Well, they're totally ignorant of the what the Constitution's all about to argue that that his First Amendment rights would be violated if he wasn't allowed to do that, because the NFL is not the federal government. So if the NFL were to proscribe it and say you cannot do this, it would not be an impingement on the First Amendment freedoms, because it's not the government telling him that he can't do that. A lot of folks skip over this, and it's really, really important to understand that all of the First Eight Amendments to the Constitution, including the Fourth Amendment, only apply to government action. The second legal blast from the past is going to be from Horton versus California, which is an incredibly important, one of the most important judicially recognized exceptions to the warrant requirement that we have in the Fourth Amendment. Now, the Fourth Amendment fundamentally says that all government searches and seizures must be reasonable. And in order for a government search or seizure to be reasonable, you have to have one of two things. You either have to have a warrant that's reasonably executed, or you have to have a judicially recognized exception, or what I refer to as a JRE. And the plain view seizure exception is arguably the most important judicially recognized exception, and allows for warrantless seizures of evidence. But there are, and like there are with all the judicially recognized exceptions, there are limitations and there are rules, technical rules regarding the application of each specific judicially recognized exception. And with the plain view seizure exception, you have to have lawful observation of the object to be seized, lawful access to the object, and the incriminating character of the object has to be immediately apparent without any further manipulation or investigation. It has to be immediately apparent. And that is the plain view seizure exception. If you are in a place, if you're a law enforcement officer with search and seizure authority, if you are standing somewhere where you have a right to physically be present, and in that area where you have a right to be present, you have lawful observation and access of the object to this object, and it's immediately recognizable as evidence or contraband, then it can be seized without a warrant, and that seizure will still be reasonable under the plain view seizure exception. Now, I add the word seizure in there because a lot of people just call this the plain view exception, but some folks confuse the concept of something that's in plain sight, which would be only number one on this list, right, with something that they can have that sees in plain view. Plain view is a seizure exception, not a search exception. So I refer to it as the plain view seizure exception, just to keep that in focus there. The next legal blast from the past is going to be the Brigham City decision, Brigham City, Utah versus Stewart. And what we get out of this, and remember, defense attorneys made an argument that the officer's motivation was really to look for weapons. That when they went into that trailer with that search warrant, they were really wanting to find guns. They were much more concerned about finding firearms than they were about finding marijuana, and that they had these subjective motivations to look for something that was not listed in the warrant. It was outside the scope of the warrant. So they were motivated to look for something outside the scope, and therefore the argument is they exceeded the scope. And the Brigham City, Utah case is a really important case. A lot of these Supreme Court cases give us much more than just one important point, but the point from the nugget from Brigham City versus Stewart that we take in this case is that subjective motivations are irrelevant in determining whether a law enforcement officer's actions violated the Fourth Amendment. The question is not what were they looking for. The question is, when they came across this evidence that they found that was outside the scope of the warrant, were they looking in a place where they could reasonably expect to find what it was that they were supposed to be looking for in the warrant? So if you're looking for drugs and you come across firearms, is it reasonable to find firearms in a place where you could possibly find drugs? And the answer in that particular situation would be yes, because drugs can be in all kinds of places. What if you were looking for something specific? What if you were looking for specifically had probable cause that there was a 60-inch Hitachi television that was stolen, serial number ABC123, and your warrant says you can go into this house and look just for this television. Not cables, not remote controls, not paperwork, just the TV. Somebody grabbed this TV out of the back of a truck and ran off with it. And the probable cause that this television set alone is in this particular house. Well, when you go in to search that house, it would be unreasonable for you to open kitchen drawers or look in envelopes and look in containers that this TV could not be in. That would be outside of the scope. But the subjective motivations are irrelevant. So the fact that they wanted to look for firearms while they were in there on a warrant for marijuana, their subjective motivations are irrelevant, and the Brigham City case is really, really good for that. And the last blast from the past I have for you is the dreaded Franks versus Delaware. And I say dreaded because those are terrible hearings. I hated conducting them as a federal prosecutor. They're a terrible thing to be a part of because they're basically making an argument that there's some type of fraud that was done upon the court by the law enforcement officer in the affidavit. I mean, this creates all kinds of issues, not the least of which is Giglio matters and Giglio issues. But the rule of law is that evidence can be suppressed if the law enforcement officers misrepresent or omit material facts in the affidavit that could affect the probable cause determination. And the defense attorney in this case is arguing that by omitting the omission of the information that this person was a convicted felon in the warrant was materially affected the probable cause determination, and the firearms should be excluded because they only found out that he was a convicted felon after they obtained the warrant. And so for them to seize the firearms plain view, that needed to be in the warrant affidavit itself. And that is at least the argument that they've made. And this is the legal blast from the past that the court is going to apply to that, whether or not what was omitted or misrepresented materially affects the probable cause determination. That's the standard that we have in Frank. So having now that we're armed with all of the information, let's take a look at what the circuit court did with this and see what the circuit court decided to do. First, the court held that the action of the maintenance man was not a search protected by the Fourth Amendment, that he was not acting, remember the rule of law that we had in that legal blast from the past, he was not acting as a government actor. He wasn't doing it with the knowledge or at the direction of the government, and therefore his actions were not government's actions. And therefore, these acts were not a search that were protected by the Fourth Amendment. He was in there with a master key as a maintenance person, and it's typically a part of Florida lease agreements. And I know that for a fact, having leased apartments, especially when I was a student at the University of Florida. I know that with the master key, they can get in. He was in there to replace the stove and the broken stove. And what he was doing was just that, there to replace the stove as a maintenance man and was not acting as an agent of the government. And therefore, it was not a search. What he did was not a search under the Fourth Amendment, and therefore it did not have to be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. The second point of the court, that the seizure of the firearms and the ammunitions and the silencer was lawful under the plain view seizure doctrine. They went in there where they looked were in places where they could reasonably expect to find what they were looking for, which was the drugs. They were looking for not just marijuana, but also harvested marijuana, as well as the tools and other things that would be necessary for the marijuana grow. I imagine they were also looking for indicia of ownership or a proof of residency as well, although I haven't seen the actual warrant itself. But the bottom line is that firearms and ammunition and a silencer, which is also considered a firearm under the federal statute, they could see all of these things when they were looking in places where they would reasonably expect to find the drugs, the marijuana. And so, therefore, they met the requirements under the plain view seizure doctrine: legal observation, lawful observation, lawful access, immediately recognizable as as evidence of criminal activity, which kind of leads to the third point, this whole concept of what they were hoping to find. Now, the court said, look, even if they were really hoping to find firearms, their subjective motivations are irrelevant. It doesn't matter as long as they're looking in a place where they could reasonably expect to find what it is that they're authorized to look for under the warrant, and then that will make the lawful access and observation that you need for that seizure to take place. And well, what about this plain view seizure of the ammunition and silencer? As I said, it was lawful, but what about the fact that they didn't put the they omitted the fact that he was a felon in the search warrant? Now, the seizure of the firearms, ammunition, and silencer are only lawful because they are recognizable as evidence of criminal activity, right? That's the third requirement on the plain view seizure doctrine. The only reason they were immediately recognizable as evidence of criminal activity is because they knew that he was a convicted felon. And so, without the knowledge that he was a convicted felon, the seizure of these items would have been unlawful. I mean, if they didn't know the guy was a convicted felon and they went into the apartment and they found the marijuana and then they found these firearms, arguably that'd been a whole different argument, one that was actually made lower at the court, at the district court level. But the argument was they knew before they went to execute the warrant, they knew, they discovered he was a convicted felon. And that the argument is that should have been in the warrant. But the court said no, because they had probable cause to search the trailer for the marijuana. And his status as a felon had no effect on the probable cause that specific evidence of a specific crime would be found in a specific location, namely that the marijuana would be found in that trailer in violation of federal law. So that the fact that he was, whether or not he was a felon, had no impact on the probable cause determination for what was actually listed on the attachment B there, or when on the items to be seized, what was actually specified, which was the marijuana. His felon status had no impact or effect on that determination whatsoever. And it's a good time to point out, and we've got a couple minutes left, that this was a plain view seizure. Even though they had a warrant, they were in the house on a warrant. The warrant only authorized them to seize marijuana and paraphernalia and grow material. So whatever it was they seized that they were looking for on the warrant would have been based on a warrant. It would have been a seizure based on a warrant. Anything else is a warrantless seizure that is done plain view, and that's what took place. And the plain view seizure had no, the information they had that created the plain view seizure had no effect on the probable cause determination. So the motion to suppress the evidence was denied. There you go. So there it is. Thanks for joining me. It's half an hour, but it just goes by so fast. It always does. Thanks for joining me. For those of you who joined me live, I really appreciate it. For those of you who are tuning in after the fact, thanks for tuning in to Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinars. I want to make you aware of the podcast that I'm doing at Broadcast Blue, and our URL, our website address is our name, broadcast.blue. That's all you have to type in the browser there. Go to broadcast.blue. You can check out information more about the Brown Bag webinars, how to subscribe to the podcast. The podcast subscriptions are absolutely free. We're on iTunes and Google Play, or you can listen to the podcast, the audio podcast, on the website itself. If you want to review the webinar videos, information for how to do that is there as well. Everything you need to know, including on how to get in touch with me at my email address, bruce@broadcast.blue. Everything you need is on the broadcast.blue website. Even have a Twitter feed, even if you're not a Twitter type of person. I tweet information on Broadcast Blue Twitter feed that actually shows up on the bottom of the page of Broadcast Blue. So even if you don't, you're not a Twitter person, you can still catch the latest on the Twitter feed on the bottom of the web page. So I want to make you aware of all of that as well. Thank you so much for joining me, and I hope to see you back next week for the next edition of our Broadcast Blue Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar series. Thanks, folks.